This is America on the Road, winner of the International Automotive Media Conference Gold Medal Award for Radio, and now in its 24th year on the air. Thanks for being with us as we bring you the latest automotive information from around the world. America on the Road is brought to you by DrivingToday.com and the Coalition for Vehicle Choice. We have a road test of a highly coveted vehicle for you this time around. Maybe two highly coveted vehicles, but certainly one of them is. I guess both of them are, as I stop and think about this. Maybe I should think about this before I start the show. I'm Jack Nerad in any case. That part I know. And with me is co-host Chris Teague. Chris, thanks so much for being with us.
Thanks for having me, Jack. How are things on your side of the world?
Things are just swell. I rarely get outside to walk around in what is pretty good weather here in Southern California. I trust that in Maine, you're probably, do you have this nor'easter bearing down on you? What's going on with that?
We do, although I think we're going to escape with far less impact than Connecticut. And to your point, I did get to take a walk today. It was 11 degrees. So I gave the dog a coat. I put on a coat and we went for a walk.
Wow. 11 degrees.
He was not the happiest guy on the
bus. Yeah, I'll bet. You write for Ford Authority, Forbes, Driving Today, among others. And I write for several of those, too, for Forbes and, of course, Driving Today and also Auto by Tell and J.D. Power. So we're covering the waterfront in terms of what we're writing for and gathering auto information for. This week, Jim Wilder of Dodge SRT will be our guest. He's going to give us the engineering lowdown on the all-new Dodge Charger SRT Hellcat Redeye. Whew, I almost ran out of breath saying that sentence. But what an awesome car. I had a chance to drive that in the Carolinas a couple weeks ago. Sat down with Jim, and he's going to tell us more than we could ever want to know about the Hellcat Redeye version of the Charger. In the car review segment, Chris will give us his opinion on what vehicle, Chris?
The Mercedes-Benz GLA 250, the 2021.
Very snazzy. And that's certainly a coveted vehicle. But I was driving a vehicle that perhaps is even more coveted, at least eagerly anticipated. And we're talking about the 2021 Ford Mustang Mach-E, which I had a chance to drive here in Southern California a couple days ago. And now I'm able to talk about that drive and describe it at some length. So we will do so in the next segment. But before we do that, let's go to our auto news segment where we can tell you about some of the latest automotive information that has happened around the globe. What do you got in mind for us, Chris?
Well, Jack, this is a very interesting vehicle that is probably not on very many people's radar given how limited it is. But Toyota just announced the second generation Mirai hydrogen fuel cell sedan. It will be arriving in the U.S. Starting very soon, they're saying this month. It's going to get a big price cut from the year before. I think it's almost $9,000 cheaper now than it was for 2020. The 2021 Mirai XLE will start at $50,495. It's only going to be sold, I think, in California and Hawaii, though. And looking at my closest hydrogen fuel cell filling station, even if they were sold in Maine, I would need to go to Montreal or Connecticut, neither of which are convenient to my front door. So very interesting vehicle. It's hard to get my head around where Toyota's going with this since it's so limited here in the United States, you know, but it is a compelling range on this car. I think they're saying it will travel 402 miles on a tank, and they're offering incentives like free hydrogen filling for a period of time after you buy the vehicle and free service. So very interesting vehicle, could be exciting if you live in California or Hawaii near a filling station. I mentioned it just because of the fuel cell. I think that's really awesome. They're kind of forging their own path there. And, you know, I think them and Hyundai are probably two of the only ones actually doing that. So very interesting. We'll be out very soon, and we'll have to see if they expand their presence going forward.
Right. I mean, obviously, the big stumbling block there is the availability of hydrogen. You touched on it when you were talking about the Mirai. I drove the previous edition Mirai. I thought it was really cool. I felt like I was driving a futuristic kind of vehicle. That's for certain. It operates essentially just like an electric vehicle. I mean, it is electric drive. It's just getting its electricity from a different source than a battery. So that part is very, very cool. And The great thing about it, of course, is you can refill it almost as quickly as you can refill the tank of a gasoline car, and off you go. So not only does it have 400 miles of range, but if you were going from hydrogen station to hydrogen station, it would have essentially unlimited range. The difficulty is you really have to route yourself in strange machinations to get to different hydrogen filling stations these days.
Yeah, it's a good thing you brought up the filling time, right? So it fills almost as quickly as a tank of gas. So that's one of the big problems with EVs right now is even if you have 400 miles of range, it takes a very long time to regain that through charging. So, but again, hydrogen is if you can't fill it up anywhere, then what's the point, right?
Right. Well, and I think that gives you a different mindset. I mean, I was talking to a bunch of electric car aficionados on the Mach-E drive, and I think you have to have a different mindset when you are driving one of those vehicles, and maybe we can talk a bit about that going forward. But I think you have to be comfortable with going, okay, I'm going to go somewhere, and then I'm going to charge for 20 minutes or 40 minutes or an hour or so, and then go on. And, you know, that's not how I do my cross-country driving. I mean, I barely stop to get gas. I mean, if they had a pit stop like in NASCAR, I would be doing that as I'm going cross-country. So it's a little different. Maybe it's more leisurely, but I'm not sure I'm ready to stop for 40 minutes and just wander around and have a cup of coffee. Let's talk about, we're coming up on Christmas. I think this is our pre-Christmas show. The next show, I think, will actually drop on Christmas Eve, but this is the week before Christmas. A lot of people are doing Christmas shopping, and we have some cars you could shop for that are particularly good deals if you want to stick them under the Christmas tree, or proverbially do that. One of them is the Lexus LS500. Very good deal on this very luxurious full-size Lexus sedan. I think we talked about a bit about the Lexus LS in a recent show, but it can be purchased with 0% financing, which we like, for 60 months. That's 5 years in my terms, and which is fairly cool. Or you could lease it for $800, $799 per month for 36 months if you come up with $5,000. So that's not so bad. Actually, it's quite good for a luxury vehicle like that. There is the 2020 BMW X3. It's available with 0.9% financing for 60 months. You have to qualify, of course, to get that. You have to have good credit. Or there's the Nissan Murano. It is, of course, a five-passenger personal SUV. And it qualifies for 0% financing for 72 months. So that's a long time. Plus, you get $3,500 in cash back. So these are vehicles that you might look for, or your spouse might give you for Christmas. Yeah, Christmas coming up. And, you know, coming up with that big, impactful gift, a car is that, certainly. So a lot of people are doing that.
It reminds me, Jack, of last week's Saturday Night Live episode, the Lexus Season of Giving, or the commercials that they have with the red bow on top of the car. A man surprises his wife with a new RX SUV, and she flips out because they don't have the money to pay for it. So I guess if you're going to buy a car for your spouse, please ensure that, you know, you're not going to get in trouble for it.
Yeah, absolutely. We don't want it to end marriages or any of that, and you should be able to afford it. But if you can afford it, impactful gift, pretty cool gift.
Absolutely.
And here's another item. It's about augmented reality, which I would like. I mean, my reality is just kind of so-so. So if they could augment it and make it even better, that would be swell, I think. Mostly I'm quite happy with my reality, but just think about having it augmented. Doesn't that sound wonderful? Well, some automakers are doing that. They're thinking about using Snapchat, you know, the messaging app, to place virtual vehicles in front of people so they can see what they're like on Snapchat before they go to buy them. I think a lot of people are shopping on their phones, so this makes a heck of a lot of sense. This whole thing about augmented reality is getting more real in terms of what car marketers want to use. I talked to the some folks over at Relay Cars. They're part of Evox Images, and they do just a wide variety of things like virtual reality and augmented reality to create a virtual showroom. So in these COVID times, when many of people are locked down, or at least supposed to be, you can do some car shopping and learn a lot about cars with virtual reality and augmented reality in the absence of going to a dealer.
Yeah, I like that. And, you know, Ford did it with the Mach-E, and it wasn't augmented reality, but there are more and more shopping tools, as you mentioned, giving you almost a full walk around experience, like you're almost right there at the car, saving you the time and the hassle, and then obviously now the safety of being in contact with other people to test drive it. So I think it's great. I also think it's great that the automakers, some of them have started looking at using augmented reality in navigation systems. So printing actual arrows and directions on the road, or displaying arrows and stuff on the road in front of you as you drive. So I think it's all very helpful, although it could be disorienting if you're just getting used to it. So
yeah,
interesting stuff though.
Pretty soon we won't be able to find our way home, but pretty cool stuff from Relay Cars, where you can actually place the vehicle in your driveway, and not just kind of in a weird way, but it actually scales to your driveway, or so you can see if it fits in the garage. So that's not a bad thing. There's some vehicles that won't fit in our garage, so we have to be careful about that.
Thankfully, I don't have I don't have a garage to worry about right now, but our new house will. So I'm thinking
about
that.
That's good. It's interesting. They were very forward thinking when they built that house in 1780 that they would also build a garage.
I know, the barn. They just built a door right there. They even had a garage door opener on it. So
that's perfect. Wow. Those people, they were thinking. They were thinking. In the next segment, Chris will be taking a look at the Mercedes-Benz GLA 250. And then I will give you what I know, which I guess is kind of quite a bit, about the Ford Mustang Mach-E, the much-anticipated all-electric Ford Mustang. So stay with us for that. With Chris Teague, this is Jack Nerad with you. And thanks so much for being with us right here on America on the Road. Welcome back, everybody, to America on the Road with Chris Teague. This is Jack Nerad with you, and we're so glad you're with us. We really do appreciate you joining us here on America on the Road. And let me ask you this, too. If you like what you hear on America on the Road, please pass us along to a car buddy of yours, somebody who also cares about cars. I think would enjoy the show, so please let them know about it if you like it. If you don't like it, well, you know, keep it to yourself, but... Thanks so much for being with us. We appreciate it. This is Road Test Time, and we have Chris Teague talking about a very zooty vehicle from Mercedes-Benz. Tell us all about it, Chris.
I was testing the 2021 Mercedes GLA 250. This is a 4MATIC, and this is also a hatchback-shaped vehicle. It's not quite a crossover, although they have moved it closer to crossover for this generation. So 2021 is a new generation. It's a refreshed vehicle. It's definitely a little bit more SUV-like the previous generation. You'll hear a lot of people say, especially with the AMG version, that it's a hot hatchback or a hatchback. This one rides a little bit higher. The seating position is more upright, and you're taller in the cabin. So definitely feels more like a crossover, though it still has a lot of sort of hatchback proportions and size. So this car had a 221 horsepower turbocharged 2-liter inline four. It also made 258 pound-feet of torque. Very nimble vehicle. I felt in control. It's very confidence-inspiring. It's very light. It feels very light on the road. It's comfortable inside, too. The front seats are very well padded. This trim level, this options package equipment had at about $50,000, but it came with heated seats, no cooled seats. Still very comfortable inside, well-finished, nice materials. There's metal and brushed wood and different surfaces inside that make it very interesting. Plenty of storage up front. I really like Mercedes' deep center console, as well as the large glove box. And there are all sorts of little cubbies and things around up front to store phones and purses and stuff. So worked out well for the family. To be such a small car, it had a surprising level of cargo space in the back. We were able to throw my 60-pound hound dog and two suitcases in the back for a road trip. He had no trouble. Generally, he whines if he's not happy, and he seemed to be okay. The infotainment system here is the MBUX. It's the Mercedes-Benz User Experience, I think is that. That's what that stands for. It's very responsive, colorful screen. I will lodge a complaint against the touchpad control system. It can be a little finicky to get used to where you're aiming your finger and where to touch. Once you get used to it, it's okay. There is quite a steep learning curve there. And the gear shift, I think, would probably be my second complaint to lodge against the vehicle, although it's a little bit less so. So where you're used to the windshield wiper controls on most vehicles is where Mercedes put the gear shift lever on several of their newer crossover vehicles, too. So once you get used to where it is, I'm sure it'll be fine. But for a week, I kept reaching for the gear shift while I was trying to turn on the windshield wipers. Let's see what else. One thing I really enjoy about Mercedes, especially with their current lineup, is that they've been able to split up most or a lot of their vehicles into sort of the performance AMG line and then also the more pedestrian, just regular Mercedes-Benz vehicle. And I think that's done a lot of favors, especially with vehicles like the GLA, because they can focus on making them comfortable and practical and usable every day without having to also make them sporty. Because if you want the sporty ride, you could just get the AMG. And what that has been, what the effect of that is, that it just feels like a more cohesive and effective and focused vehicle. So everything just works together. The vehicle handles well. It's got a nice pickup, and a comfortable interior. So overall, it's a great effort. I'm glad that they made the move to a more crossover E shape for the vehicle because it makes it more useful for people like me. But it still, like I said, feels nimble and small around town. So good effort by Mercedes.
And I think it's one of those vehicles where you look at the price and you go, wow, that seems like a bargain. Now, you don't necessarily have that feeling all the time with Mercedes-Benz products, but I think with this particular GLA, it's reasonably priced. Would you say so?
I agree. It's hard to call something that costs that amount of money a bargain, but for what you're getting, it is. You get a lot of what you would spend on a large, like the big Mercedes, the expensive Mercedes, in a smaller package and for less money. But, you could still find as much content in something like a Kia, especially, or a Hyundai now for less money. But for what you're getting, it's a decent price.
Yeah, absolutely true. So it's a vehicle I certainly like. I like the looks of. I think Mercedes-Benz has done a great job with their styling recently, and I think their model line is pretty coherent and understandable and makes a lot of sense all the way around. So you can get the sporty, as you say, or you can get them not quite as sporty, sporty enough for most people, I think, in the standard line, not the AMGs, and be quite happy. So we like the people to be happy. Happy, happy, happy.
Exactly. I will come back and correct my earlier price statement. This one checked in at just under 45,000, so not quite 50.
Okay. Yeah, 45,000 bucks. So yeah, get a Mercedes, you get the three-pointed star and everything about a Mercedes in that GLA. So pretty cool. Well, here's another vehicle with an interesting brand, and that's the Mustang brand. And when you think about it, Mustang has been around for close to 60 years. I think it's 56 years. And yet there has been nothing beyond the Mustang. I guess if those with really long memories can remember the Mustang II, with some degree of chuckling, I think. But it was essentially a replacement for the Mustang. It wasn't like an addition to the line. Maybe it should have been. It was kind of like a baby Mustang all the way around. But this time around, there is a new Mustang. With the current Mustang that we know, the coupe, as many of the English-trained Ford engineers talk about it, and it is the Mach-E SUV that is coming to market almost immediately. I had a chance to drive it. I was one of the lucky journalists who was on a recent drive event that Ford had here in Southern California. And so there are going to be the sports coupe model that we're well aware of, the convertible version of that, of course, and now the Mach-E SUV. And it's all electric. That is the other thing that is very, very interesting about it. And it's, I think by making it a Mustang, and I talked to the Ford engineers about this at some length, it gave them focus. Prior to that, they were doing this kind of midsize or small all-electric SUV, And it was nameless and kind of formless. And then when they thought about, hey, this could be a Mustang, I think that brought a lot of things into focus. And they it helped them with the styling. It helped them with the performance. It helped them with a lot of things. And that's all been has come to fruition in the vehicle that I was able to drive, because it is all that. It's a performance vehicle. It has a lot of the Mustang spirit in it. At the same time, and I actually gave my 19-year-old daughter a ride in it when I had it to get her take, get a take from a different generation than mine. And she likened it to a Tesla. She immediately drew that just from looking at it, actually, even before we went inside. And then when we went inside and saw the giant infotainment screen and those things that kind of echo Tesla, even more so. And then the drive, of course, is an electric drive, which means almost silent, very powerful. The GT version of this, which is yet to come to market, and I did not drive, is expected to have 480 horsepower. The vehicle I drove had a more reasonable, I guess, I like 480 horsepower, but 346 horsepower was just fine. And of course, the torque is substantial, 428 pound-feet of torque that comes on, boom, right away. I mean, this is a vehicle that can really accelerate. They say with the GT, of course, the higher horsepower version will accelerate from 0 to 60 miles an hour in 3.8 seconds. That's plenty fast. I mean, that was exotic car territory 15 or 20 years ago. So this is a vehicle that's a lot of fun to drive. Has plenty of room for five people. Some ingenious storage, of course, where an engine would normally be in the Mustang coupe up front under the hood. You have a storage area. In fact, it's a drainable storage area. You can store some cold drinks in there if you want. And you put ice in there, and then the ice will melt and drain away. So that's very, very cool. Plenty of room in the rear of the vehicle as well, being an SUV, it has plenty of storage space and some ingenious ways of using that storage space. Very nice ride. You do get the sense that it is heavy or that it has a low center of gravity. It doesn't feel slow at all, but you get that sense that, you know, this is not a absolutely lightweight vehicle. It's no Lotus, that's for sure. It has three driving experiences, and they are named, and don't chuckle, or maybe you can, they are named Whisper, Engage, and Unbridled. So, yeah. So they, the marketers got hold of that.
Did you feel engaged while driving it?
I was engaged, and on the other hand, I didn't feel unbridled. And to tell you the truth, I'm not sure I should feel unbridled, number one, but I didn't note that much difference between the three modes. And that's one of these things that's got to drive engineers nuts, right? They tune a vehicle to a particular spec and they want it to be like that. And then it's like, okay, we'll make it work three different ways. change the things up and make them noticeable when they're changed. And I don't know that that's necessarily the best way to go about things. I think if you're going through different types of terrain, off-roading, and you have different vehicle modes for each of those, maybe that makes sense. But I'm not sure that this added a whole bunch. I love the drivability. It's nice that you have the fact that this changes. And it does change the graphics on the instrument panel. So if you want, say, orange, go unbridled. all in all, I like the vehicle a lot. I think it does things that Tesla doesn't do in an interesting way. I think it is in some ways very true to the Mustang heritage, and it certainly is a performance vehicle, a fun-to-drive vehicle. It has the next generation of sync in terms of communication, so it's a very, very good interface, and this massive touchscreen. You could show movies on it. You shouldn't do that while you're driving. But all in all, this is, I think, a home run effort. It is competing in the North American Car of the Year, Utility of the Year, and Truck of the Year competition, of which I'm a juror. And I'm sure it's going to do well in its Utility of the Year area. I can't say right now that it will win, but you know, it would be an odds-on favorite to win in the utility segment, according to one out of 50 jurors, me. This is a really good vehicle, and I think Ford has done a great job with this. I think the fact that it is a kind of focused on Mustang did a lot for it, and there are very, very good things about it. In terms of, I should mention, of course, electric vehicles, so I should talk about range. They being Ford, estimate range at least 300 miles in rear-wheel drive configuration. So that's a nice amount of range. And then between that, you go to Starbucks, get a cup of coffee, let it take on more electrons, and then you go about your business after that. So very cool. Mm-hmm.
I was not one of the early lucky journalists to drive the vehicle, but I have been told that it will be trailered to my house in the near future. But I don't have a problem with the fact that they call it Mustang. In fact, I think it's, like you said, it gave it focus and helped them get a good product out the door. And I also think that the vehicle does a lot of what Ford needs to do to modernize itself for the future. So you mentioned the infotainment screen in the new version of Sync, which is now Sync 4. And that enables over-the-air updates for them. So that will help them extend their product range or product line time frame, because they, like Tesla does, can start updating the vehicles remotely. And the new system will be in the F-150, also the 2021 F-150. So they're going to be able to change the way the vehicle drives and some characteristics, you know, electronically and over the air via the connected modem, that you won't have to go to a dealership. You don't have to buy a new car. They're just new features will appear over time. And I think that's a really big step for Ford, and it's a great move for, you know, kind of a legacy automaker to make.
Yeah, I think it's absolutely terrific, as long as it works.
Yes.
You know, I've been in some cars where they just decided, as I was sitting at a stoplight, to update the system, and that's more than a bit disconcerting to have happen. So as long as that stuff is working, I'm 100% with you, and I think Ford is onto that and onto the fact of what they really need to do. So I think... You know, this is going to be a winner in the marketplace. I think a lot of people will really love the Ford Mustang Mach-E.
I agree.
So when we come back, we'll be taking your listener questions. That's what we're going to do next. And Chris Teague will be with me answering questions that you have given us. So stay with us for that right here on America on the Road. Welcome back, everybody, to America on the Road with Chris Teague, Jack Nerad with you for question and answer time. We love to take your listener questions. It's very easy to reach us. editor@drivingtoday.com is where you would send your listener question, and then we'll answer it on an upcoming show. Thanks so much for reaching us at America on the Road. And so let's go to a question. Here's a listener question from, I think, Illinois. What are the most reliable 10-year-old cars? That's a pretty good question.
I agree. And if I had to take a guess, and I do have to take a guess because that's what you're asking me, I'm going to say that the number one most reliable 10-year-old car is a Lexus or a Toyota. And in fact, because I just sold my 10-year-old Lexus and it was running like a top. So I think that's probably a good choice. I think there's probably going to be a Toyota Camry, a Honda Accord, and a Toyota Corolla on this list. Am I right?
Could be. I mean, it's our opinion, so we're allowed to have them. I mean, I don't think there's one definitive answer. I mean, I certainly did some research to put together a list, but yeah.
Okay. Well, in that case, then yes, a Lexus or a Toyota or a Honda will be the most reliable 10-year-old car. Although Hyundai and Kia have made a big run at quality in the last decade, and I think you could probably get lucky with those guys as well.
Right, and there's another brand I don't believe you mentioned that deserves to be on the list, and that is Buick. Buick builds very dependable cars and was building dependable cars a decade ago. And the Buick LaCrosse is on the list, and maybe another Buick or two. And certainly, I think you mentioned Hyundai and Hyundai Sonata Certainly deserves to be on the list, their mid-sized car, and that continues to be a very reliable car to this day. And then, as you mentioned, a lot of the Toyota and Lexus models have extreme reliability.
Yeah, you mentioned Buick, and I almost was shocked for a minute until I realized they have the 3800 V6, which is like literally unkillable. So I think that's probably not that surprising in light of that information.
Yeah, I would say they're not the most exciting cars necessarily, but they absolutely do hold up. And the Buick people screw them together very well. So there's a lot to like about those, especially if you're looking for a transportation car and not wanting to spend a lot of money, which is kind of the definition of when you're looking for a transportation car. And so all of these are pretty good choices. But if you bought a LaCrosse, say, or an Avalon, you'd be getting a lot of car for the money, I think.
Agree.
Well, I hope it was interesting to you, and we had a little guessing game out of it, so that was fun. And like I say, we love to take your listener questions, so send them to us here at America on the Road. And when we come back, we'll be talking with Jim Wilder of Dodge. He will give us the engineering lowdown on the all-new Dodge Charger SRT Hellcat Red Eye. Boy, he's got a lot to say about it because he was intimately involved in engineering this vehicle. He loves it, and there's very good reasons to love it. So just look for that interview with him when we come back. So with Chris Teague, this is Jack Nerad. Thanks so much for being with us right here on America on the Road. Welcome back, everybody, to America on the Road. Jack Nerad back with you. And we are so pleased to be at Carolina Motorsports Park with a great guest for you, a really interesting guy who has a terrific job. I mean, I can't imagine having a better job than what Jim Wilder has at SRT on Charger and Challenger. How cool is that, right?
It's a great job. I love it. I've been doing it for, gosh, 14 years. So it's not a job that I intended to vacate at any time. It's like, this is the dream.
Let's dive in. Going fast. I mean, I lived through the golden era of muscle cars. I'm old enough to have lived through that. Maybe I caught the tail end, but, you know, didn't. Now, we're really at the golden era of muscle cars, aren't we? Talk a bit about that first.
We really are. I mean, if you go back to the 60s and the early 70s, I mean, yeah, those were great cars. They were fast cars. People have lots of nostalgia about them. But the cars we have today have more power in entry-level positions, let alone the high-level ones. You're talking 800-horsepower street cars. They get good fuel economy. They have air conditioning. They stop well. They do all these things well. And you can drive them across the country comfortably.
That's, I think, what's so amazing about these cars. And we're talking about Challenger SRT and Charger SRT, among others. But is that they're dual use. I mean, you can use them as an everyday vehicle. And here we are at Carolina Motorsports Park. You can use them as an everyday vehicle. And then they just have mind-boggling performance potential as well. Talk a bit about how you're able to do that.
It's really amazing. The technology gets us there. You know, a modern engine is a far cry from the engines of the 60s. And then the technology in the suspension, the brakes, the tires, tire technology has gone leaps and bounds. And it really does almost year over year. You think it's round and it's black and it's rubber, but no, there's a lot of technology in them. One of the things that really gives us a lot of range of authority, I would say, is, you know, give it that Jekyll and Hyde nature, is the suspension. With the three-mode shocks that we have on the car, you can take the car from a very pleasant ride in street to a very aggressive ride in track. So good for both situations. You drive to the track in street, you press a button on the radio, you're switched over to track mode, and you're ready to go.
Yeah, you're ready to go. And with levels of performance that would put so many sports cars of a decade ago to shame, right?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely.
Let's talk about horsepower first, because it really gets a lot of attention. And you're pushing up toward 800 horsepower now.
Right.
Tell our listeners about the power plants available in the SRTs here, and then let's talk a bit about that.
So the base powertrain in an SRT Challenger Charger today is a 6.2-liter supercharged Hellcat. That's 717 horsepower. In 15, when we came out with that at 707, it just blew people away that we eclipsed 700. And then in 18, with the Demon, we upped it further. We put a bigger supercharger on it, went from a 2.4 to a 2.7-liter blower, spun it a little bit faster, about 300 RPM more, and got 808 on pump gas, 840 on 100 octane. Just mind-numbing numbers for a performance street car. Boost is obviously hugely important. The technology that's in the engine, I'm not the powertrain guy, I'm not the engine guy, I can't dive too deep into it, but I mean, to be able to do that in an engine, get over 20 miles a gallon on the freeway and make emissions, it's crazy.
Yeah, make emissions and make it live. I mean,
and make it live.
You know,
yeah.
Back in the day, you would get that kind of horsepower maybe for a little while,
yes.
But you would not get it for any kind of lengthy period of time or any kind of reliability that you could say, okay, this is a family car and we can just, you know, drive back and forth, you know, to the grocery store in it, and at the same
absolutely.
Time go to the track. It's kind of nuts.
My track car, I've got a drag car, and it makes 650 horsepower from a 440, naturally aspirated, but it is nowhere close to streetable. Race gas, high compression, big cam, and it idles at 1,500 RPM. These things idle at 800 RPM and make emissions and make more power.
Right. You have a well-rounded package in SRTs, right? I mean, I think that's part of the mindset, right? It's not just...
Yep.
A devoted drag strip car or a devoted roundy round kind of track car or whatever.
Right.
It does all kinds of things. How do you get all that together?
I think it's the way you focus on what your objectives are. You know, the Demon was a pretty track focused car. Cars like ACR Vipers were very track focused cars. So that was the top of the ladder objective, the prime objective. Our objective with all these standard SRTs are to make them really good street cars as well as the best track cars they can be. Some of our competition, and like the ACR Viper, is that a car you want to drive every day on the street? Probably not. There's probably some guys that will, but for the most part, not. So we're really trying to balance that ride and handling and make sure the car is manageable for driving to church on Sunday morning and then driving home from church and going to the drag strip with the same car and performing really well. So it's really the way you set the objectives and then the technology you put in to do that.
Is it engine management that allows a lot of this to happen? I mean, computerized engine management versus what we had when we had essentially mechanical.
Certainly. Yeah. I mean, going way back to carburetor days. Yeah, absolutely. We've got camshafts that move and we've got fuel injection. We control the boost very accurately to manage the torque level. Having an 8-speed transmission in the cars gives you all kinds of torque multiplication, so all kinds of driving authority. You know, when we switched from the 5-speed to the 8-speed, the cars got dramatically faster just with a transmission change. You were always in the right gear. Compare that to a 3-speed of yesteryear. I mean, it doesn't compare.
Yeah. You're always in the right gear because the transmission is so smart. It's part of it, right? I mean, this transmission is probably smarter than most drivers, or it's certainly smarter than I am, I would say.
It's really smart, and we've got different modes for it. So depending on what mode you're in, it knows, geez, he switched to track mode. He is at a racetrack. When he hits the brakes, I need to start downshifting because he's going to a corner. So the smarts are there for that. And then when you're in street mode, it's a pleasant ride. It knows what you're trying to do with the car. It's calibrated to do those things.
Yeah. What do you think are some of the things that these cars offer that the typical potential buyer of these cars maybe doesn't know they offer, but they should know, or some advantages you have that they don't know
about?
You know,
I think it's kind of what we've been talking about. I think it's the dual nature of the cars. The cars get talked about. The big power numbers always get talked about, right? And that helps sell cars, and that's a big thing, and it's a great thing, and it's a really important thing to the performance of the car. But I think the other side of the car, the street manners of the car, are something that people really need to understand too. That it's not just a big power car. Do they go 200 miles an hour? Absolutely. If you got enough road and enough guts to do it, they can go that fast, but they can also be really pleasant family sedans to drive around.
I think that's the real revelation that I had when I first started to drive SRT vehicles, is not that they were fast, because I've driven a lot of fast cars, and I spent a lot of time doing that. There was a time when you gave up a lot for that speed, right? You gave up all kinds of utility and comfort and a variety of reliability, a bunch of things.
Right.
Now it doesn't seem like you're giving any of that up, and if anything, it's enhanced. Talk
yeah.
about that.
Yeah, that's true. That's true. And it's the tech that's in the cars again. It allows us to have that ability to do both sides of it, to really have a comfortable car. Do we give up things? Of course, there's always compromises. If we made the car stiffer, would it handle a little bit better? Yeah, it probably would. Would you want to drive it every day? Probably not. So we're really trying to get both sides of the customer's requirements. I mean, most people don't race these things every weekend. Most people want to have the people that buy our stuff want to have a fast car. They want to have a big, bad, you know, baller car that they can drive around and show off to their friends. Do they track them every weekend? Probably not. But the car is capable of doing it. But it's also capable of driving him and his family or her and her family around all the time comfortably.
Do they track them much at all? I'm kind of curious about that. And if so, what kind of track experience
for
do they
certain.
Have?
Yeah, for certain. In fact, some of the tracks that we go test at, we'll see a track day event happening maybe the day before, the day after us. And we'll see SRTs roll in. And that goes from Challengers and Chargers to Durangos and Grand Cherokees as well. I think if you ask customers, the majority of them drag race them over road race them. I think some of that is accessibility. There's lots of drag strips, and it's cheap. You can go to a drag strip and get in for $20 to $30 for a test and tune night and maybe $50 to race. You don't go through a set of brake pads. Your tires last. You know, a road course is a bigger commitment. There's inherently more risk. The costs are higher. And certainly, true or false, there's the sense that road racing takes a lot more skill than drag racing. Being a drag racer at heart, I would argue there's a lot of skill in drag racing as well. But it's pretty simple to go to a drag strip and just start from ground zero and go do it.
Yeah. And with launch control, maybe it takes some of that art of launching out of the equation that used to be there, right?
Sure, sure. Yeah. And we like to set up our cars as driver cars so that all the electronics in the car don't do the driving for you. We like that. We know our customers like that. They need to have input to the car. Demon, I think, is a perfect example of that. ACR Viper is a really good example of that, where you, as the driver, you need to take responsibility. What your right foot is doing and what your left feet are doing, or your left foot is doing, is really key.
Yeah, well, it's always key now when it gets right down to it, isn't it? Let's talk about going fast in a straight line.
Sure.
It's something you talked about in the presentation this morning, for one thing. Tell us a bit about that, you know, the state of the art of going fast in a streetcar these days.
I think the Demon really was a chance for us to enhance that performance in a vehicle. In 2015, when we came out with Hellcat, it was very evident that was a really good straight line car, could be a really, really good straight line car. So it was, you know, the thought of doing a Demon type vehicle then was born early on. We had lots of discussions about how to do that. And when I gave the presentation on the Demon, I used the simple equation, F equals MA, force equals mass times acceleration. I need to capitalize A as much as possible. So you look at, how do I optimize force? You do it with gear multiplication. You do it with torque converter multiplication. And obviously the motor is a huge contributor to that. But then you also look at mass. And we went after mass pretty significantly. We took about 200 pounds out of one of those cars to get that thing to accelerate quicker. But there were some firsts that we did with that car to really enhance it. Drag radials from the factory. Nobody had done that before. And if you're really going to do a drag car and really accelerate in a straight line as quick as you can, you need the right tire, especially when you're talking about the power levels that we're at. Trans brake was another first. And, you know, these incremental things that we did all picked up so much performance in getting the car from zero to the end of the quarter mile
as quick as
possible.
Well, and you talked this morning, and it was interesting to me, about that first 60 feet as being so critical.
So critical.
Tell us about that and what you're able to do there to maximize on that.
Yeah, the first 60 foot, whatever you do in the first 60 foot as far as an improvement is multiplied two or three times at the end of the drag strip. It's an old drag racer rule of thumb, but I'll tell you what, it's really accurate as well. So getting the car from stopped to rolling is so key, and a lot of that comes down to traction. A lot of that comes down to the grip. So for the Super Stock, it was really obvious what we needed to do. We've got these Demon tires that we developed. We got to put them on the Super Stock. And that is such a huge improvement in on-drag strip performance. That drag radial is designed to live in that environment with some rubber and glued surface. The other thing we did with Super Stock was we used the trick from the 1320 and the Demon as far as the suspension tuning. Planting the rear tire with a firm suspension in the back is key to being consistent and getting the power down to the ground. But then in the front, you soften the suspension and rebound to allow the front end to travel and transfer weight to the rear. So not only am I planting that tire hard in the rear, I'm taking weight off the nose and putting that on the rear of the car to, again, help plant the tire and get that 0 to 60 foot timer down as low as I possibly can. And that's what throws you into the back of the seat at the launch. And in this case, it keeps you pinned there pretty good with 807 horsepower.
Let's talk a bit about the drag tire, even more specifically, right? Because yeah. I think to the uninitiated, and our listenership is pretty much not racers, they're mm-hmm. generalist car enthusiasts. There is something non-intuitive, I think, about a drag tire. Talk about that.
So the drag tire that we started with was a Nitto NT05. It's an off-the-shelf aftermarket tire that they sell to lots of people around the world. We started with that size because it fit on our car. And then we went and reconstructed the tire. And when I say reconstructed it, we looked at different compound, we looked at belt angle, we looked at sidewall construction. And it's one of those nuances. Again, people look at tires as black and round and they're rubber, and there's really a lot more to the science of it, such that every time we'd go out and do a submission, as we call them, we'd look at three or four different construction and compounds and evaluate them and assess them, not only at the drag strip but on the road as well, steering and noise and things like that. But those little nuances all get tweaked to match what the car wants. And every car is a little bit different. You know, when you buy an OEM tire from the factory, from a dealership, it's designed for your car. There might be another tire of the same size, but it wasn't designed for your car. And all those details really add up. So the compound on these things is very soft. There's not a lot of tread pattern in it because you want as much contact surface to the ground as you can. What does that give up? Well, obviously, if you don't have a lot of tread pattern, you're giving up some rain performance. And people are very well aware of that, and we try to make them even more aware of that the best we can. But for what that dedicated usage of that car is, it's the only way to go.
Did you change wheel size and profile for the...
So that tire is an 18-inch tire. So it's an 18-inch wheel. We had to come up with a new wheel for it, an 18 by 11. The standard Hellcat in 15 through 17 was a 9.5-inch wide by 20. So we stepped down in wheel size, and it gives it more sidewall, which is also good. You'll see pictures of drag cars starting at the starting line. You see the sidewall flexing and there's ripples in it. That's allowing the tire to grip. So that's important. That's really important.
What are some of the other things that people should know about SRT as we kind of conclude the interview that you think they don't know?
So I think SRT, you know, SRT is kind of a separate platform from the rest of FCA, and we've got a pretty dedicated group of gearheads that work on our stuff of a very similar mindset, and I think that's key to any success. When you've got people thinking of the same way about a car, that really, you feel the passion that people put into it in the final product. We used to talk about pillars at SRT, you know, outstanding powertrains. I think that's still a really big key to the programs that we do. We've got to have mind-numbing amounts of power for the dollar value. Ride and handling balance, critical. Again, we talked about that, having the street performance and the track performance. Interiors don't get a lot of airtime, but I think that's really critical too, because that's something that you touch as a driver every single day. So having little touches on the interior, being leather, Alcantara, carbon fiber, all those little details kind of add up to make a racy kind of interior. Exteriors, we try to make our exteriors work and functional. We do make them functional and work, I should say. You know, aero balance is really critical for a high-speed car. Having too much lift makes a car unresponsive at speed. Having not enough downforce in the rear makes the car unstable at speed. So we really try to balance those things and make them functional.
Right, and getting enough cold air to the engine, right?
We got to have cold air to the engine. You've got to have inlets. I mean, all these little details. Braking is super critical. We're putting cars on the track. You can't fade the brakes in a lap. They've got to last lap after lap after lap. So there's a lot of details in the car that I'm not sure the average person knows that we look at really hard and make sure they work in a street environment and on a racetrack environment.
Yeah. And I think the cool thing about these cars is you can live with them every day, have all this performance, not give up anything really, in fact gain from having an SRT versus the other versions of these cars. I think that's a really cool takeaway that I've learned over the course of several years now.
Well, that's something we certainly take pride in, and I appreciate hearing that.
Well, Jim Wilder, thanks so much for being with us. We really do appreciate it.
Thanks for having me on.
And stay with us, everybody. We'll be right back right here on America on the Road. And that was our interview with Jim Wilder of Dodge, talking about the really exciting Dodge Charger SRT Hellcat Red Eye. What a car. What a blast it was to drive that vehicle. And we thank him so much for giving him his insight into that vehicle. I don't think there's anybody who knows that vehicle any better than Jim Wilder. And speaking about people who know stuff, Chris Teague is our co-host. He knows a heck of a lot about cars, and it's a blast always to have him on the show. Thanks so much for being with us again, Chris.
I have to clear the blushing off of my cheeks here. That was a very, very nice compliment. But I will thank you for having me, and I'll thank everyone for listening. And if you like what you heard and you want to get more of what we're giving, please hit the subscribe button and leave us a review wherever you get your podcast. That'll help us continue to grow and get in front of more people and hopefully bring them along for the ride as well.
Yeah, Chris talked about giving too, and that's really why we're here. We hope to give you some information that can be useful for you. So thanks so much for joining us to hear that. And if you care about giving, you might care about my recent book, The GR Factor, Unleashing the Undeniable Power of the Golden Rule. Check that out at Amazon and Barnes & Noble and bookstores near you if you would. The GR Factor by Jack R. Nerad. That's me. So check that out. And thanks so much for being with us on this edition of America on the Road. Merry Christmas to all of you out there. And we look forward to joining you again when the next episode of America on the Road appears. And I think that's going to land on some people's doorstep on Christmas Eve. So thanks so much for being with us. And join us again next time right here for America on the Road.